In the first session, I talked about a book called The Limits to Growth. It was published in 1972 and created quite a storm. Up until the time this book was published, it had been assumed that questions of equity in distribution of income and wealth among the nations of the world was not a serious matter, because if you think of the income of the world as being like a pie, the industrialized, wealthy nations of the world had some pretty big slices, and the poor nations had small slices. That was true, but everyone felt that if the people who had small slices would just get busy and work hard, they could make their slices as big as they might desire, because there was no sense of any limitation as to how much growth there could be in the economy and the resource utilization of the world. This book really raised a serious question about that. It pointed out that as population growth increases, as resource utilization increases, as industrial activities create more waste and pollution, that there probably is a limit to the amount of population, human population, and industrial activity that the planet can support. And they actually came up with some estimates. That was a revolutionary idea, and we have not yet by any means come to terms with that idea, and it's one that's going to be debated and argued for a good while to come yet. I think increasingly people are beginning to feel, however, that not all of the world can live at the standard of living that people in the United States, Japan, Western Europe are living presently, and that some sort of accommodation is going to be needed, some attention to the question of justice of distribution among nations, among peoples. And that ultimately has to come to the point where governments begin to think about appropriate actions in sharing or making accommodations between nations, foreign assistance, trade arrangements, things of that sort to promote equity and some greater measure of justice than exists at present. Now, at the time the Limits to Growth book was published, I was working at the Council on Environmental Quality in the Executive Office of the President. This was under President Nixon. I found it to be an interesting place. It was not as exciting as I had hoped it would be, because the person that we reported to at the White House always seemed rather preoccupied. His name was John Ehrlichman. Sometime later, we discovered that he apparently was rather preoccupied with a break-in at the Watergate apartment. I guess sometime in 72 or so, I left, or 73, I left the Council on Environmental Quality and went to New York to work for the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, where I was, I say somewhat facetiously, I was paid to help the Rockefellers give away their money. And in a sense, that's correct. And I worked there for about 4.5 years. And when the Limits to Growth book came out, and before I went to New York, I was quite interested in the reaction of government officials to the book. There was many different agencies undertook reviews of it, attacked it, every one of them attacked it and essentially dismissed it. One of the, there were lots of totally irrelevant reasons that were given for dismissing it. Two, however, that that kept coming up that seemed to me to be really kind of falsely stated were, number one, that the government had no data whatsoever that would support the conclusions in that book, and number two, that the government did not have a global model. This work was all done with a global model. And I, at the time, could see no way to really effectively address those, what seemed to me to be irrelevant and untrue dodges. But later, an opportunity developed. And this this opportunity developed as a result of the action of one individual who was a kind of a middle-level bureaucrat at the Department of State. His name was Donald King. And Don had read the Limits to Growth book and was persuaded that the government should perform a serious response to it. And he bided his time and waited, and finally, when Carter took office, there was an opportunity that showed up. There was a desire on the part of some people in the White House to send what was called an environmental message to the Congress. And a message from the president on anything is nothing more than a kind of a flowery statement about something. But it doesn't have any money attached to it, and nothing ever happens except a lot of press releases are written. Well, this was to be an environmental message on the Congress, on the environment. Well, Don happened to know the two people who were in charge of writing this, and so he got out a piece of paper, put it in his typewriter, and typed out two paragraphs calling for a study. And took it around and met with them, and actually met with them on the sidewalk in front of the White House, and proposed that they put in this idea of a long-term study. And as Don remembers the conversation, these people said, well, to date all we've got is a lot of very specific things in here that we're proposing. And one that was kind of broad and general and sweeping would probably be all right. So Don took out these two paragraphs out of his pocket and gave it to them, and they disappeared into the White House. And those two paragraphs got inserted. It went through a review process, and in brief, those two paragraphs got into an 18-page document. It went into the Oval Office. Came out with Jimmy Carter's name on the bottom. Whether Jimmy Carter read it all, I don't know. And I've never had a chance to meet with him and ask him, and I doubt that he'd remember if he did. But the two paragraphs were there and had his name on them, and they read as follows. The essence of them is as follows. I am directing the Council on Environmental Quality and the Department of State, working in cooperation with other appropriate agencies, to make a one-year study of the probable changes in the world's population, natural resources, and environment through the end of the century. And this was dated May 23, 1977. Well, the first thing I heard about this was when I was on vacation in Maine, Bar Harbor, Maine, camping there with my family. And I called back to the office for some reason and told that there was somebody in Washington trying to get in touch with me. It was a man named Charles Warren. And he was the chairman of the Council on Environmental Quality and was the man really responsible for getting this study done. So I called him, and he wanted me to come to Washington and meet with him about the possibility of directing the study. I went down in my camping clothes, and we had a fine meeting, and he said, "I want you to meet an Assistant Secretary of State who will be responsible with me for this." So I went out and bought a necktie to go with my camping clothes and went for a meeting at the State Department, and went back to Maine. And the next morning I was to call and was offered the job. And by evening we were about 300 miles closer to Washington, and things moved very quickly then. And I'll have to say the Rockefeller Brothers Fund was very helpful in giving me a leave of absence to do it. The first day on the job was a real education in what it's like to do this kind of thing within the government. In the first place, 1 year for a study of the future of the planet is, it's cutting it a little tight. On the first day, I discovered that there were two staff people, one at the Department of State and one at the Council on Environmental Quality, who had been asked to find the study director. And both of them, as it turned out, wanted the job themselves. And so they had spent 6 months looking for a study director unsuccessfully. They just couldn't find anybody. And so the chairman of the Council on Environmental Quality, Mr. Warren, took on the job himself and finally decided to ask me to do it. So 6 months of the year was gone when I arrived. So there was 6 months, I'll beg your pardon, that's getting long enough ago that I've forgotten part of the story. It was 3 months that they'd spent working on that. But the report was to be printed at the end of the 3 months, or the 12 months, so I called the government printing office that day and discovered that they wanted 3 months to print. So I was down to 6 months to do this whole study. Furthermore, I discovered there wasn't any money. Don King had been very wise. He had not put any budget into those two paragraphs, because if he had, it would have gotten crossed out by the budget people, but there wasn't any money, so there was no reason for them to cross it out. So I didn't have any money. There was no staff. There was an attic for an office. So I had one office and an attic. That's the space that was available. And whatever money I had to, I had to have some money to do the study, but whatever money was to be there, I had to raise myself in addition to doing the study. So one of the first things that I did was to write a letter, which Mr. Warren signed, to the secretaries of, 10 different government agencies, Department of Energy, Department of the Interior, places like that, Department of Agriculture, Environmental Protection Agency, saying that the president has directed that we prepare a study of the future of the world. Your agency should be involved, and we want you to come to an organizing meeting. So I came to the organizing meeting and sat down at the head of the table and pretended like I knew what I was doing, and said, "This is how we're going to do the study. It has to be done quickly, and we need your data. We're going to need some analysis from your people. And by the way, we need $50,000 from each of you." there was a crucial moment, because if someone had stood up and said, "This is a lot of nonsense, a waste of time, nothing's ever going to happen out of this, worthwhile," it could have really killed the study right then and there. But one person happened to have been from NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, stood up and said, I think this is really important, and we're going to get you $60,000 before the end of the week. Now, with that kind of a statement to open things up, the discussion, it became hard for others to be kind of a wet blanket on it. And many of them simply didn't say they were going to help, but didn't say they wouldn't either. So I thought that was a pretty successful meeting. And went away, wrote down in one day an outline of everything I'd ever wanted to know about the world and which agency I thought ought to know, and sent it around to all the agencies and said, this is your assignment to prepare these projections, this analysis. I need to pause here for just a moment and tell you why I took the job. There had already at that time been a number of serious studies of the future of the planet, and another one really wasn't going to shed any enormous new insights. But this would be the first time that any government had done such a study. And the directive that President Carter signed indicated that the study was to serve as a foundation for longer-term planning and thinking within the government. Now that interested me. I liked the idea of undertaking a study whose purpose was not necessarily to be the definitive study of the future of the world, but to establish a foundation for some ongoing, longer-term thinking within the government. So I undertook the study with that thought very much in mind. As I got to working with Mr. Warren and a number of the others, it was clear that they weren't interested in that matter at all. What they were interested in was having a definitive statement about what the future was going to be, and on the basis of that, to be able to argue that their agency should have a whole lot of new money to undertake this, that, and the other thing. But that was not really my primary interest. So when I designed the study, I designed it in such a way that the agencies were instructed not only to give me projections about what they thought was going to happen in the future, but they had to tell me how they were getting their projections. Now, almost all of them were using some kind of a computer model, some kind of a black box, out of which comes wisdom about the future. And I want to know what's in the black box. Now, Mr. Warren, when I talked to him about this, couldn't understand at all why on earth I wanted to know this and why it would be relevant. But he said, all right, I can see you feel strongly about it. Okay, you can do it that way if you want to. So those were the ground rules. And we set a deadline for the first draft. I think I gave people a month to get the first draft done. We had 6 months to get it all done, so 1 month seemed a reasonable time for a first draft. At the end of a month, there was not a single word that was available. So I organized a weekend-long retreat and invited all the participants, the agency people, to come, and of course announced that the agenda would be primarily each one standing up and giving a report on what they had accomplished. And there's nothing like having to stand up in front of a group of people to say what you've gotten done, to get you busy getting it done. And we had a wonderful weekend. It was a year when the Redskins were doing well, and the Redskins were playing that weekend, and people gave up watching the game to come to this this meeting. And an interesting thing happened there. I had gone around to virtually every agency of the U.S. government and identified the people who were responsible for the long-term global thinking in each one of these agencies and brought them together at this meeting. And the thing that was such a surprise to all of us was that not one single person who was responsible for the long-term global thinking in any part of the U.S. government had ever met anybody else in the government with a similar responsibility. They were all total strangers. The guy in agriculture didn't know the guy in energy, and the energy guy didn't know the one in census, and the census one didn't know the one responsible for minerals. Never had they ever met. So it was a pretty exciting time for them to meet and exchange stories and phone numbers and things of that sort, and begin to work for the first time ever as a team, thinking about the future of the planet and what the U.S. Government should be thinking about in this regard. Well, that's how we got started. And we had a draft done in 6 months that could have been published, and it would have been an answer to the president's request. It wasn't very good, I have to say. It showed a lot of potential. And as a result, a decision was made to extend the deadline for another 6 months. And this happened again and again and again, never with enough extension to allow me to hire people with any kind of assurance that they could stay on for a while. It's hard to find people, good people, who are just going to drop everything and go to work on something for 6 months. But that's all the time extension I could ever get. Well, we went through a lot of work, and one of the political decisions that I made in it was to refuse to work on the summary of the work, this little thin volume, until the technical report was done. One of the big mistakes that was made in the management of the Limits to Growth study was to publish this little book without the technical backup document done. So I refused to work on a summary until the technical report was done. And as time went on, people began to get a little bit more of a sense of what this was, and there began to be some alarm about whether it was raising issues that there wouldn't be any immediate answer. One interesting story about this book is that Aurelio Pache, who headed the Club of Rome, the group that sponsored this, took it to the Soviet Union and met with German Gavishiani, Kosygin's son-in-law, and asked if they had had it, and yes, they did have it. Has it been translated? Yes, it's been translated. Will it be published? No, it won't be published. He said, well, why? And Mr. Gavishiani said, well, Dr. Pache, you need to understand something. In our society, one does not raise questions to which one does not already have an answer. And that's also true in the U.S. government. It's not unique to the Soviets. And people were beginning to worry that this study was raising questions to which there weren't answers. So there was a time in which it was not clear to me that the report was ever going to see the light of day. And a lot of pressures and problems at that time. One chapter in particular was really very difficult. It was a chapter dealing with the global environment and what's happening there. We'd had a draft done, and the person who had done the draft had to leave to take another job. And then a large committee was organized to review it. And it took me one full year to rewrite that draft to their satisfaction. There were just so many things happening to the global environment that the most government officials knew nothing about, that they couldn't accept it, couldn't believe it, and demanded reference after reference. That one chapter has 776 references, many of the references being big, long lists of citations of things. And I have said, and I will continue to say, only slightly facetiously, that if I said the water runs downhill, I had to cite Isaac Newton. And it was almost to that point. There was demand for reference after reference after reference. And then, you know, just to give you a slight taste of the kind of pressure that there was, when I got all of that done and it had finally been approved, the person who was causing the most problem on it and seemed to be most ignorant of the matters demanded that I go back to the library, look up every one of those references to see that I got the page numbers right. You know, that's the kind of things that were happening. Mr. Warren had been a great help, and at the end, finally had to leave office because of family problems and moved back to California, and a new chairman of the council came in. That was the beginning of a very difficult time. He, for reasons that I can only speculate on, made life very difficult for me. I think it's fair to say he would have liked to see me leave, and I didn't. One of the first things he did was to move me out of the office I had and put me in what used to be the Xerox room in the basement with broken chairs and one tiny little window that looked out into some ivy where the rats ran by. There were lots of rats, let me tell you, in the area around the White House. we did finally get the technical report finished and off to the printer. And then one very fortunate thing happened. When the technical report went to be printed, there was a letter that went with it saying, you can print it, but you have to hold it. Don't release any copies at all until we have the summary done. And even at that point, there was a possibility that they could simply destroy the copies and never release the thing. By some great stroke of good fortune or act of God or whatever, the government printing office lost the letter of instruction and proceeded to send out copies of the technical report to all of the depository libraries. You know, each state gets several free copies of every government report that is published. So all of a sudden, there were copies of the Global 2000 technical report that were appearing in state libraries and university libraries all over the country. And at that point, there could no longer be any question that the report was going to be released. And it changed rather markedly the attitude toward getting it out. Well, then we started on this summary volume. And it was quite a challenge to write this. It went through 14 separate drafts for 50 pages. I would write a draft, and the government people would edit it and take out all of the important substantive ideas in it. And it went back and forth, and twice I was removed completely from any responsibility for writing this, and they were going to turn it over to someone who had not worked on the study, but that they controlled very very carefully. That person actually went and wrote a draft of the study, which was terribly watered down, and it was given to me with instruction to review it and give me my turn in comments, and they would get it printed. Instead, I took the copy, the draft that they had given me, and I sent it to the professional people in all of the 14 agencies that had worked with me and asked them to review it and send me written comments. I then wrote a memorandum to the chairman of the Council on Environmental Quality and to the Assistant Secretary of State to whom I responded or reported, and said, you are the two people who are ultimately responsible to the president for getting this report done. And you have the ultimate authority for deciding what goes in the report. As a study director, however, I think I need to tell you that if you produce a report anything like the one that you have sent to me as a draft, it will not reflect well on the president and could end up being a serious political embarrassment. And agencies have reviewed the document, and I enclose their comments. It was only after doing something like that that I was allowed to get back involved in writing that report. And even then, there was great difficulty in even being heard on much of this. One of the things got a little bit more difficult then when one of the members of my staff decided that it was a hopeless situation and proceeded to write a letter to some of the top aides to President Carter saying that there was a Watergate-style cover-up in progress at the Council on Environmental Quality and send me copies of the letters. So I was then in a situation where I either had to wait until the letter came back from the White House to my boss or to go up and show my boss that the letter had been sent. I just went up and showed it to him. But that's the kind of tension under which we were working to try to finish this report. In the end, I think that I got most of the things that I would like to see in the report. What it says, I need to, I guess, make a little bit of a comparison between these two documents. This one does analysis out to the year 2100. Now, it's a fairly long time horizon. The government's report stops at the year 2000. So they get, now we're getting pretty close to the year 2000. So it's not, there is a lot of government data that shows that there are some very, very serious problems in the world. And if one looks as far as another 100 years, they could easily be factors that would limit the kind of growth that's possible. It could cause an uncontrolled and rather severe decline in population, which was a conclusion of this book. I think the government analysis also suggests that there are a lot of ways in which the planet could be managed so that the needs, the basic needs of a very large number of people could be met for a very long period of time. But to do that would require some rather significant changes in public policy. Now, that much I think is clear in the book, and I think is a correct representation of the analysis. There are some things that are not well stated in the analysis that I simply couldn't get in. Probably the most important thing is described in chapter 14 of the second volume. And it's a chapter entitled The Government's Global Model. We found that the government does, in fact, have a global model. It's different than most global models in that the demographic sector is in a computer at the Bureau of the Census, and the agricultural sector is in a separate computer at the Department of Agriculture, and the energy sector is in a yet different computer at the Department of Energy. But these sectors all do interact. And the way they interact is that, for example, the Bureau of Census will make a run of its demographic sector and get population projections for the world. Then they take all that computer printout and they edit it and they take it to the government printing office, and the government printing office prints a report, and the Department of Agriculture buys the report and sits down, punches up all the numbers and puts it into their computer. That's the way all these sectors interact. At something that we described as glacial speed. What we were able to do is to find all the ways in which these sectors interact and to speed them up rather substantially. The models are still not designed in such a way that you can even take a tape from one and put it into the other computer, but we did make quite a bit of progress on it. Now, what we also discovered by looking at what's inside the models is that the agencies are making a whole lot of assumptions that flatly contradict each other. The people at the Bureau of the Census, for example, are assuming that population growth rates are going to slow down substantially because economic conditions are going to improve all over the world. Food conditions are going to improve all over the world, things of this sort. Well, when you look at the economic projections, they assume, or they conclude, that economic conditions are not going to improve very rapidly. And nonetheless, they will improve more than you might expect because population growth rate is going to slow down even more than the Bureau of the Census says it is. So there's just gross contradictions from one sector to another, many of which could not be worked out in the time that we had to work on this. But the net effect of these kinds of inconsistencies is to bias the government's view of the future of the world in a far more optimistic way than would normally, than would be the case if you did it more carefully. That kind of assessment of the government's analytical capabilities simply couldn't get put into the report. And I would have liked to start the report saying something to the effect that, Mr. President, you asked us to prepare a study of the future of the world as a basis for preparing or improving the government's forecasting capabilities. And we did the best we can, but we have to tell you that there are some severe problems with the government's ability to do this kind of thing. Instead, the report begins like this. If present trends continue, the world in the year 2000 will be, and then it goes on. It starts with a great sense of, we know what we're talking about. And that is totally misleading. But that sentence was totally off limits for my editing pen. I was not permitted to have anything to do with that. It's also totally misleading to say if present trends continue. What it should say is if present policies continue. And the person who wrote that told me that she couldn't understand the difference between trends and policies. It was all the same. It isn't. Well, this report was published. How are we doing on time? Excuse me? About 40 minutes. I'm talking too much. Let me just wrap it up quickly to say that the report was published at the end of the Carter administration. When the Reagan administration came in, and even during the campaign, Reagan was asked about the report. He had not read it. He was briefed on it by Bill Ruckelshaus on the campaign plane late one night. And I've never heard this story directly from Ruckelshaus, but people who did hear it from me tell me that he got about three sentences into the discussion and Reagan's eyes glazed over, and that was essentially the end of the briefing. Later, when he was asked about it by the press, he said, well, a long time ago there was this Reverend Malthus. People who were there say he did not know how to pronounce Malthus. And that Malthus thought we were going to run out of food, but Malthus didn't know about pesticides and fertilizers. And that was the end of his response. And that's published in the New York Times. You can read that there. When Reagan came to office, he went out of his way to have this report discredited. The Europeans, particularly the Germans, wanted to do a lot with it. There was a proposal from the Philippines that this report be the agenda for the Cancun Summit Conference, and Reagan vetoed that. They've done one thing after another to downplay the report. But you know, as far as we're concerned here, I think the point to know about, the thing to remember, is that there is now a government report that is as well done, as carefully researched as you can do it. It's also very candid in discussing the limitations of the report, which supports the idea that we can no longer take for granted that the question of justice in development and the question of equity among peoples of the world can simply be swept under the rug by assuming that growth can continue forever. It's no longer really possible to assume that everyone in the world can have the standard of living that we have in the United States, and that questions of justice, questions of equity, are going to have to be dealt with in a much more specific kind of way in the years ahead. So I want to stop there and see what questions you have.
What's happened in the preceding 10 years? Have your thoughts in there been affirmed by what's happened, or how's it going to be succeeding?
Well, my thoughts are not in there. You know, what's in there is the best analysis that I could wring out of the government agencies.
Okay.
And in some cases, it was pretty hard to get anything out of them. Particularly on minerals, the Department of Interior simply refused to write the report. And I hired a fellow from Dartmouth, I think he was a junior at the time, and gave him a stack so high of interior reports to write the chapter. And they didn't like it at all, and really dumped on it. And I wrote a letter to the Secretary of the Interior, and I said, I'm quite prepared to put a statement on the front of this that this chapter is the weakest chapter in the book, and it's weak because the Department of the Interior refused to write it. Now, if you want me to write that, that's fine. If you don't, you better get somebody working on it. You know, it was that kind of lack of cooperation that was really tough. But as far as how things have held up, I'd say that a lot of the things that are in here really have stood up. The problems of food and environmental deterioration in Africa are really strongly reported here. The energy prices are not currently as high as we projected that they would be. But I think we're not... I think it's a little premature to tell how that's all going to settle out. Yeah.
Do you know if any other kind of work has been done? Do you know if any other kind of work has been done by colleges or by other groups other than government since Reagan has ignored it with the study itself?
With this study or?
Yes, with the technical study that went out to the university.
Oh, there's a lot that's been done. It's sold 1.5 million copies in 8 languages, and an enormous amount of additional research has been done. And there are other study projects that have been undertaken, particularly outside the United States. It's been hard for people who want to study these things to find funding over the last 8 years. But there's a major new report that's just been published by Westview Press called Globus, G-L-O-B-U-S. And it's a very large-scale global model that was developed with funding from the West German government at the Wissenschaftszentrum in Berlin. And that, that I think, will be the new standard global model that is used, because it will work on a microcomputer and is far more powerful and sophisticated than anything the U.S. government has, even. So a lot will be done with that model. Yes?
Well, the conflict you described seems endemic to our system, namely that this Congress can run on two-year terms and senators on six-year terms, and they don't seem to see more than 5 minutes past the end of the term, probably not more than days ahead of what they're doing. This was discussed last part of the morning meeting with Falls Church conference, which you participated in. That ex-congressman made that same point. It's very difficult for Congress to see beyond. And that's one problem. The other problem seems to me that, that at least in our recent past, we can see that people who have a less than the most positive outlooks or predictions on the future of our own lives tend to lose elections. Chris Mondale wants to raise taxes and have some more severe environmental controls. And of course, Carter in 1980, I think that was part of the reason why he probably didn't make it again. That the sort of Reagan, rosy picture that Reagan has given us for the last 8 years sells. And I just wonder if you have ideas, how does it, like I say, this seems so endemic to our system that it's going to be difficult to deal with these issues, isn't it, on a political scale? How would people stay elected, stay in office, and still deal with these severe problems?
Well, it may be that but it's not going to be possible until there is a major disaster. And even then, there may be difficulties. In the study of Ephesians that was going on this morning, we talked a little about discernment. And a big problem with discernment has to do with what you call paradigms. Now, you get a mental picture, a mental model in your mind about how the world is or how your life is or whatever. And when contradictory evidence comes along, it's very hard to see that your image is wrong. One little example, I have a friend who is a pilot and thought himself a very good pilot. And a very good navigator, and he was flying through some clouds over the Alps. He was a European. And ahead he saw the strangest cloud he'd ever seen. He'd never seen a cloud, anything like that. And it was not until he was about 100 feet away from it that he realized it wasn't a cloud at all, it was a cliff. Now his paradigm was that I know how to fly, I know how to navigate, I can keep this plane going right where I want it. And if there's something ahead, it's got to be a cloud, can't be a mountain. Well, he flew right into the side of a mountain and fortunately survived. But he had all the time, an enormous amount of time to change course, but he couldn't see that he couldn't recognize what was in front of him because his paradigm wouldn't let him. Now we're in a similar situation. We believe, we have believed for a very long time, that the free enterprise system will produce endless wealth. And we believe that there are no limits to what can happen in terms of expanding our wealth. Changing that is going to be a long-term, difficult undertaking. We believe that you don't have to worry about distribution because if those lazy people with black skins or whatever speak Spanish would just work a little harder, they could be as rich as we are. It's going to take time to change that way of thinking. And I'm not even sure that a major failure will bring people around immediately to see that that view of things is wrong. It's going to be a hard thing to change. So I don't have a quick, easy answer to that. Yes?
This is kind of in the best of all possible worlds scenario.
Yes?
In the best of all possible worlds, if we would all be convinced by what you've said, by what these reports said, and would want to act accordingly, what would be the three policies that you would think we should enact or implement in order to avert the kind of catastrophes that might be ahead?
Well, I think the number one thing that I would put on the agenda is paying attention to the life support system of the planet. We can't hope to see human beings go on having a happy, prosperous future if we destroy the very systems that we depend on to keep us going. In China, when we were working there, we found that the Yellow River has 50% more soil and it's silt in it now than it did at the time of the revolution in 48. China can't go on indefinitely dumping its topsoil into the sea. We can't allow the ozone layer to be destroyed and get to the point where we get sunburns just from being out a short time, and that we get skin cancers from working in the fields. We can't allow things to get to the point where cows and all the other animals go blind as a result of sunburned retinas from depleting the ozone layer. I mean, those things are enormously significant. You know, the whole life support system in many ways is really under serious threat. So I guess I'd put that very high up on the list of priorities. Another thing that I put very high on the list of priorities is diverting expenditures away from armaments and toward dealing with the underlying causes of conflict. An enormous amount of conflict takes place in the world over resources, especially over water. A lot takes place also because of religious conflict. The church could do a great deal to get rid of the need for expenditure on arms by finding ways of making peace among different religious factions. But we need the money to deal with some of the really badly damaged parts of the life support system. And spending it on arms is not a very satisfactory approach. So, those are two. I guess a third is that we've got to give as much attention as possible to the reasons why people want large numbers of children. The facts seem to suggest that if you increase the living standard of people to the point where they can have some education, the desired number of children per family goes down. And that's going to be very important. If parts of the world go on with women having 6, 8, 10 children, with 3.8 or so population growth rate, that's a disaster coming. That's a big disaster. But simply handing out pills and condoms doesn't stop that problem. You have to get people to the point where they don't want the children. They want 2 or 3 children. But bringing infant mortality rate down is absolutely essential. in providing meaningful roles for women other than being mothers many times over is essential. And it's going to take time to bring those about. But those are, I guess, three things that I would point to that are really important. Okay, let me repeat those two questions. One is, are there people in government that, once Reagan's gone, are going to be coming forward and be more effective? And the other is there something the church could do that would be more effective, more useful on the matter of population? On the government side, let me say that there was a more thorough house cleaning than I think ever before when Reagan took office. At the Council on Environmental Quality, where I was based, every single person was fired. There's not one person kept over. And locks on the doors were changed. That's the degree of thoroughness. And if these, the kinds of issues that are in this report were such an anathema to the Reagan administration that if you had any support for it at all, even, you know, I know specific examples where people just even brought up the fact that they worked on it, that was really detrimental to your career. There's one person in particular that whose career suffered very badly as a result of having been associated with this. Some of them are still there, but this has been a period where, 8-year period, that if you were seriously interested in any of these kinds of issues, you better keep it to yourself. So yes, I'd say there's some possibility, but I think that it's going to require some major changes in personnel in order to kind of bring this along. Even more damaging, the Reagan administration decided that the data sources were dangerous, that people were using data to point things out, so they discontinued the collection of data in many very critical areas. And erase data tapes and things of that sort, simply to eliminate the information on which you would do research in some of these areas. Now, what could the church do on population? Well, I think the first thing that the church could do is look at the matter right at home. I'm not aware that the church has anything to say of any real profundity on stewardship with regard to human fertility. We don't talk about that. You know, it's just not there. Another thing we could do is to make family planning a part of our development assistance programs. I have served on the Standing Committee for Mission Service and Development of the Lutheran World Ministries. That was the group in New York that all of the synods before the merger participated in and decided how to spend the World Hunger Funds and contributions that were going through the churches to Lutheran World Ministries and to the Lutheran World Federation. And it's impossible to get either of those organizations to do anything with regard to family planning because the presiding bishops won't let it happen. So something very useful could be done right there. Another thing that, to the degree that we support things like this, Bread for the World gets a lot of support. Bread for the World just won't talk about population, and I think it's a real mistake to be supporting a group that feels that the only answer is feed more people without talking at all about the side of doing what you can to bring fertility rates down. The two have to go hand in hand, in my view. But you know, and beyond that, you could do something more with advocacy in the government. But I think the church itself has to put its own house in order before you can really deal with that. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering about what you see in the last 10 years in the light of not expecting very much in a shift of the paradigm in the United States at this point, right? It's, it does seem to be you're telling us that the United States is not going to be the place where leadership is going to be emerging on these issues in the globe. As you look around, are there signs in Europe, in parts of developed Asia, or even in parts of the articulate third world, where, or in the Soviet sphere, where you see more, at least beginning shifts towards raising the kinds of issues that you don't see the United States capable of raising at this point?
Well, I think that the United States is still unique in the extent that there is a community of people here who think globally, and you don't find that very much anywhere else. But there are some things that are happening that are really good elsewhere. Gorbachev has done things that it would be wonderful if the United States could do. That man has really made some important changes, really important. But you'll find pockets around the world. The things that have happened in China are rather remarkable as well. Some good, some not so good. But there's a lot of people looking more to China as a model of development than there are to the U.S. now, I'd say. Japan has done wonders in terms of being realistic about the technology. Japan is vastly ahead of the U.S. in terms of solar energy, for example, and energy conservation measures generally. But I think Japan is not going to be a leader in terms of the overall kind of strategic plan or goal for global development and security. Japan is just too focused on, centered on Japan. So I'd say yes, there's some things going around, but we have to pay our part too, or play our part of the role. There's something really significant for the U.S. to do yet. Well, I need to stop here. We're run over, but I'd be glad to take more questions afterwards. So let's formally adjourn at this point, and any other questions you've got, I'd be glad to talk with you about it. I should say the next time we're going to start talking about the security side, the nuclear weapons in particular, and defense budgets, and how that bears on this whole collection of issues relating to the future of the planet. Okay, thank you.